Another big vote today on Brexit. We're going to stick around for a while if that's all right with you, EU. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, I do believe, the 14th of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Stop me if you've heard this one before. Well, no, wait. Never mind. Don't, because I know you have. There was a big Brexit vote in the British Parliament today. That makes it 3 days, three big votes. Today's was to ask the European Union, pretty please, to push back the date on which the UK will leave the European Union from March 29th to date TBD. So it has been a rough week for the Brits. But spare a thought here, would you, for the other 27 members of the European Union, because Brexit ain't no picnic for them either. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard gets us going.
The UK is the EU's largest single export market, bigger even than the US or China, and so the manner of the UK's departure from the bloc is critically important to the EU, says Ian Bond of the Centre for European Reform in London.
A no deal which results in the erection of tariff and non-tariff barriers and so on would be particularly damaging to the EU economy as well as the British economy.
Brexit could be damaging in other ways too. Hans-Olaf Henkel, a German member of the European Parliament, laments the loss of a powerful pro-business, pro-market voice in EU affairs.
It was always Britain which could protect us from these state interventionist policies, mainly proposed by France and some of the southern European countries.
And Britain, says Peter Klepp of the Open Europe think tank in Brussels, has helped keep European markets more open to international trade than they would otherwise have been.
Britain was always on the side of the opponents of protectionism, so that voice will be weakened.
With Brexit, the EU will lose $12 billion a year in British budget contributions, as well, says Hans-Olaf Henkel, as losing its second largest economy.
It is a disaster for Europe.
But after this week's humiliating shambles in Parliament, many in continental Europe seem to want to be rid of Britain, said one German commentator. Stop this agonising spectacle now. No one can stand or understand it anymore. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Boeing shares lost about 1% today as airlines and their passengers try to digest the grounding of Boeing's 737 MAX series aircraft. The company itself, meanwhile, has another challenge in the coming days and weeks, how to get its message out to the flying public. Felicia Miller is a professor of marketing at Marquette University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Does it seem to you that Boeing had a crisis plan, had a communications plan ready for this?
I think it's highly likely they had a plan. It's not clear that they actually executed their plan. They think they're ready, and then a scenario happens like this, and that's a little bit different than what you probably planned for. So they were probably, you know, caught off guard by that and scrambling a bit to try to reconcile their statement from the first crash to the second one.
Right.
That came across as a genuine point of view that they could feel confident in.
Is it your considered professional opinion that they've caught up now and that they have a handle on their communications?
Based on the most recent communications, I think they're doing what is typical, which is to choose the most likely cause behind the crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, they're standing behind their plane, saying they've got 100% confidence in its safety. And I think it's highly unlikely that they are 100% certain that that's true.
Hmm.
But that's the best face that they can put on the situation at this point.
Let me ask what it will seem like a perhaps self-interested question, but I'm sure other journalists have the same one. We had Mr. Muhlenberg, the CEO of Boeing, on the program, six, 8 weeks ago, whatever it was. And we obviously have been calling Boeing saying, hey, would you like to come on the radio again? Why do you suppose they are not putting their well-spoken, passionate, and informed CEO out front?
There can be a number of reasons. One, because they don't want that individual to be on the record saying something and then in the next days or weeks find out that that's not exactly the case. So they're in some ways likely trying to protect the credibility of their CEO in the hopes that they are able to withstand this crisis. The other possibility, which I would think is less likely, is they don't really have a good solution yet for how to deal with this crisis out in, you know, the public sphere and communicating not only with its consumers, but its stakeholders and stockholders and other people. And so they may be retooling, trying to figure out what is the best next move now that they've put a statement out there.
Do you think he has to come out at some point and say something?
I think the expectation of the buying public is that the CEO will stand in front of them and say what needs to be said. And the longer they delay doing that, the more suspicious it seems. And it also brings into bear, you know, well, maybe there really is something else going on here.
Dr. Felicia Miller, she is an associate professor of marketing at Marquette University. She runs the marketing department there as well as the chair. Professor Miller, thanks for your time, ma'am. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
On Wall Street this Thursday, a whole lot of moving around, not too terribly much change. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The latest from the Census Bureau shows sales of new homes fell almost 7% December to January. The monthly numbers do bounce a lot, right? We should say that. They do bounce. But new home sales have been generally sluggish for the past couple of months, in part because not as many new homes are being built. And that, in turn, is fueling a remodeling boom because more people are living in older homes. A report out from Harvard this week found spending on home improvements and repair has grown by 50% since the recession to more than $400 billion a year. And as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, it is not just aging houses driving that trend, but aging homeowners, too.
When you're 67 years old, like Batya Gilbert Coplow in Skokie, Illinois, these are the sorts of things you think about when remodeling a bathroom.
Where the seating should go, the contrast of the shelves so that they're easy to see and that you don't hit your head, the surfaces so they're not slippery.
To make those changes, Coplow hired a certified aging-in-place specialist, Shaney Abrams. Abrams says simple things like switching out the doorknobs for easier-to-open flat handles can make a big difference.
You don't have to do complete remodels to be able to help accommodate for aging-in-place. But you do need to think about it and ideally to be proactive.
And more people are doing that. Abby Will is a researcher at the Harvard Joint Center for Housing Studies. She says the number of older homeowners has grown 60% in the last two decades.
42 million homeowners are age 55 and over today, but they've also increased their spending.
A lot of that is just on basic repairs and maintenance. 40% of houses now are more than 50 years old. Will says older homeowners are also more likely to have the means to make those renovations as their home equity has grown.
That's an incentive for homeowners to do more projects, to do larger projects. It's a confidence booster.
Making a house more senior friendly doesn't have to cost a lot. Ivar Alexander owns Mr. Handyman of South Austin in Texas. He says small projects like widening doors to accommodate a wheelchair might cost a few $100s, and even significant renovations might be cheaper than an assisted living facility.
The cost of those is extremely high, and for a fraction of that, you can modify the house and stay there, stay where you are.
Of the $50,000 to $60,000 Batya Coplow of Skokie has spent bringing her 1950s home up to date, the aging-in-place stuff only cost a few thousand. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Amy was talking about home remodels and older people doing it. We are going to go down to McAllen, Texas now to talk about first-time home buyers because the median home price there is about $136,000. That's $85,000 or so less than the national figure. But The politics of President Trump's wall and also McAllen's proximity to one of Mexico's most dangerous cities, Reynosa, makes the real estate scene in McAllen a little bit different. For the latest in our series, Business at the Border, Marketplace's Andy Euler set out to get a sense of the McAllen housing market.
Luis Lopez is checking out this yellow three-bedroom, two-story house about 15 miles north of downtown McAllen.
My budget, I want a place in like 150s, 160s. This one's 135, but he needs a lot of work.
Lopez has lived in the area for 23 years, helps his parents run a catering business. He rents a place right now, but feels ready to buy.
And it will be about the same amount of money, so I'd rather spend it on a mortgage than being paying someone else rent.
The 1,500-square-foot place Lopez is checking out today is listed under the median home value in McAllen of about $140,000. It's that kind of affordability that brought real estate investor Amira Khalifa back to her hometown about 3 years ago. She and her husband were living 5 hours north in Austin, where the median home price is above $350,000.
We loved Austin, but moving back here, I mean, the cost of living is so much cheaper.
They bought a 1,700-square-foot place in McAllen for $125,000. That's $71 a square foot. She was paying more than twice that in Austin. Khalifa says McAllen's affordability really hit home the other day when she was doing her taxes. She was comparing her tax bill from her house in Austin, which she still owns, with the one in McAllen. And then...
literally, I messaged my husband, it's like five times cheaper to live in McAllen than it is Austin.
Maybe a bit of hyperbole, but property taxes in McAllen are lower than Austin, which means the city's public schools get less funding. That hasn't stopped McAllen from becoming a bit of a boomtown. The population is surging, and sales of existing homes in February were up 8% over last year, bucking the national trend. Some of those who have moved to McAllen, they're affluent Mexicans who fled drug-related violence across the border. Ben Ruiz is a sociologist at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley.
There's a lot of money invested here by people from Monterrey and from Reynosa, whomever can afford it.
Especially those Mexicans with cash. It can be a bit tricky for Mexican citizens trying to land a mortgage. Maria Gonzalez found that out recently when she borrowed money to build a house in North McAllen. Now, she's a U.S. citizen, but she got financial help from her two brothers, who are both Mexican citizens. She says that threw a wrench into the process.
They're going to ask you a lot more, like a down payment, a huge down payment. It's a lot harder.
And buying a house takes longer for Mexicans. More paperwork, more financial scrutiny. McAllen realtor Ronnie Ontiveros thinks it's not just the hassle. She says Mexicans are starting to find the city less inviting as political tensions rise.
Border wall issues, they don't feel as welcome. And we had a lot more Mexican nationals that used to come and buy homes here. But within the last couple of years, that's declined.
At least that's what she's seeing with her clients. She says there will always be Mexicans who want to move to McAllen, though, as long as violence south of the Rio Grande River remains a big problem. In McAllen, Texas, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
He basically patrols the entire plaza. He's got a set path that he follows.
Your local mall might be getting a security upgrade. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here we go. The Dow Industrial is up a fraction of a percent, 7 points, 25,709 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ down 12 points, a tenth percent, 7,630. The S&P 500 down close to a tenth percent, 2 points, ended at 2,808. Like I said, not a whole lot of change. General Electric, GE, up 2.8%. Today, the company is setting conservative profit targets for 2019 and promising a better performance in 2020. GE says it is set to spend $2.5 billion on restructuring this year. Light end of tunnel, GE investors are surely hoping today. Facebook's top product executive, Chris Cox, is leaving the company in one of the highest profile executive departures in nearly 10 years from that company. Unrelated, Facebook and Instagram are back online after an outage that lasted almost 24 hours. Facebook's ticker lost 1.8% today. Tesla gained 0.3%. The automaker is expected to unveil its Model Y crossover tonight. Bonds fell just a bit. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note held steady, 2.62%. You're listening to Marketplace.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry, Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryznall. A story now about the economic and business concept of vertical integration and the playground concept of just because you can do something does not mean you always ought to. AT&T, as you know, is working out the kinks in its acquisition of Time Warner. It's a big merger, so there are a lot of kinks. Today's example is the conglomerate's DirecTV Now streaming service. It's dropping channels like Comedy Central and A&E from its bundle and adding HBO, which AT&T now owns, and raising the monthly price. Cheapest option is now $50 a month, up from $40. So prioritizing content it owns, raising prices. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson takes it from there.
Buying Time Warner kicked AT&T's debt to eye-popping levels. So part of raising prices here is giving the company more revenue to offset that debt.
The price increase goes into effect very quickly, and you get the uplift to revenue and free cash flow very, very quickly.
Jonathan Chaplin with New Street Research says that's a priority for AT&T in order to keep its borrowing costs from spiking. But it's not a great long-term strategy.
You lose subscribers, but you lose them over time.
The move also allows AT&T to cut some content it has to pay for and showcase what it owns instead, namely HBO. Daniel Ives, managing director with Wedbush Securities, says HBO is a big draw.
That's really their horse in the race to compete with the likes of Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, and Disney coming out with their streaming service this year. That's why HBO is so critical to the ultimate success of the deal.
But he also says AT&T can't increase prices too much because when its merger with Time Warner was challenged in court, the company argued the deal could lead to cheaper prices.
I think it shows a defect in antitrust cases and the way they're handled.
Eric Gordon is a professor at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business.
What happens is that companies and their economists say that a merger will lead to lower prices, but the companies don't actually promise to lower their prices.
The arguments they make in court aren't binding. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
I went down the street the other day, a couple of blocks from Marketplace World headquarters here in downtown L.A., to a place called The Block. That's B-L-O-C.
Oh, look at this. I have never been here in my life.
It's what's called a mixed-use development. You see a lot of them across the country nowadays, office spaces and a hotel, along with a bunch of restaurants and retail. At this one, there's a below-street-level open-air plaza with an AstroTurf lawn.
This is like the worst AstroTurf.
There was some construction going on. You might hear that. Also, a guy named Dan Cote waiting for us.
Dan Kai Ryznall, nice to see you.
Hi,
how are you?
I'm good.
Thanks for the hospitality.
Dan is the general manager at The Block, and I was there to meet him so that he could introduce me to their new security guard.
My name is Blockbot. Nice to meet you.
You have a robot.
We have a robot.
Why?
We made a decision that we wanted to go the extra step on security.
How much is this robot costing you?
I can't get into the specifics on that.
Cheaper than a human?
In some respects, I guess, because he can work 24/7.
Yeah.
But, well, we've called him Blockbot. It's up to you whether it's male or female. But to get back to your question, we did not add this robot to eliminate anybody's position. This was a totally new addition to the security team here.
So what does he do for you? Does he, like, do patrols and rounds and all that stuff?
He does. He's on a set program. He basically patrols the entire plaza. He's got a set path that he follows. He moves around for approximately 2 hours, and then when his battery gets low, he automatically goes back to his charging pad.
Can we go over and have a look at the charging? It's like a Roomba going to his own charging pad.
And so he sits here for about 15 or 20 minutes.
So holy cow, this thing is huge. I mean, it's like 5 feet tall.
It's 400 pounds.
Wow.
It's very hard to push over.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It's designed on like that on purpose.
It's a little bit, it's like a tall R2-D2.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, welcome to the block. Uh-huh. Thanks for chatting with me. If you need security, push my button again to be connected. Otherwise, wait for the green light to ask me questions.
We are going to get back to that 5-foot-tall R2-D2-looking thing in the plaza at the block, I promise, but I had some questions. Hey, Bill, Kai Rizdahl in Los Angeles. How are you?
Good, good. Greetings from Silicon Valley.
Thank you very much.
Bill
Lee is the founder and CEO of Nightscope, the company that makes the security robots that places like the block use and that can run, depending on the machine, $350,000 to more than $700,000 a year.
So Nightscope, for the last 5 years, have building an autonomous security platform, and the machines are able to generate over 90 terabytes of data a year that no human would be able to process.
Here's the thing, though. The model that I saw down at the block a couple of days ago, it was pretty friendly looking. It wasn't scary. It wasn't intimidating. It didn't exude security really at all.
Well, we've got this fine line. We've got a little bit of a similar challenge that a police officer does. Yeah. You need to be able to provide some level of commanding and physical presence and a deterrence, but you cannot scare grandma and you cannot scare the child. It's been fascinating to watch. People love to take robot selfies.
Wow.
We've got lipstick on some of the machines.
All right, that's weird.
Almost all of them have been named by our client. So you touched on it. So there's a fine line there.
Yeah.
Similar to a friendly security guard as well.
Fair enough. On that idea of technology, though, and it being a for want of a better word, a force multiplier, I'm going to play a little bit of tape from my visit down to the block here in downtown LA a week or so ago, and then I'm going to come.
All right, we got a green light.
How do I get to parking?
I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
I got one. Where's the men's room?
I'm sorry. I do not have that information.
I lost my car, and I have to go to the bathroom.
So look, I was having a little fun there, but the point is, technology is glitchy sometimes. And here you are selling this product as technology is going to keep your shopping mall, your house, your whatever installation safe.
And that's what you were fascinated with there is a concierge service that's in beta that we just started releasing to clients. And you've got to teach the machines enough for them to be able to interact. Those devices don't have the answers because they haven't yet been programmed to handle that. That's not a glitch. That's an incomplete configuration.
Fair enough. What do you do, by the way, with all the data that these things collect? I mean, there are, I think they're in, 13 states by now? There are dozens of them out there, if not more, and they've got people asking questions. You've got pictures of people. You've got location data, right?
Yeah, we're operating. We hold contracts in 15 states. We're about to be in our fifth time zone. We just got a contract for Puerto Rico. And these are all public spaces or, you know, private corporate campuses. So we're not infringing on anyone's privacy. If I put a security guard in front of your home or office, the same. That person would not be infringing.
But Bill, answer the question in the spirit with which it's intended, right? If I'm walking through this mall at 11 o'clock at night and it takes my picture and uploads to your database, what are you going to do with that information?
That data goes to our client. We send that alert to the guard, and then the guard can go investigate. It's no different than you tripping an alarm.
One does wonder what the Security Guard Lobbying Association thinks of these things.
Security guard and law enforcement professionals are looking for anything that's going to help them keep someone out of harm's way. You got to keep in mind that the employee turnover rates for security guards are 100% to 400%. It's worse than the fast food industry. They can't keep the people in the job. So instead of handing the guard a number 2 pencil and a notepad, it might be smarter to give them a tablet or a smartphone and give them access to 3 robots that now report to them so they actually have some tools to do their jobs much more effectively.
Bill, thanks a lot. It's William Santana Lee. He's the chairman and CEO of Nightscope. We got him in his office up in Silicon Valley. Bill, thanks a bunch.
Thank you so much.
You want to see that robot for yourself? I know. Good thing we took video then, huh? It's on our YouTube channel, Marketplace APM. Subscribe while you're there, would you? And now I broke him.
Okay, talk to you later.
This final note on the way out today, just because I know you are grinding away on your taxes, right? Right? Come on, you only got like a month, peeps. Anyway, the IRS is out with its latest update on the 2018 tax year filing season. Total returns filed so far this year down 2.5% from the pace a year ago. But, and this item too, the average refund is up just a hair from $3,004 to $3,008. Just because it bears repeating, y'all know that if you get a refund, you've been letting the government use your money for nothing, right? All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's up just a touch today, 7 points. NASDAQ down 12. That's about a 10%. S&P 500 down close to a 10%. Works out to about 2 points on that index. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Heron Bekela, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.